Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the world of academia is usually divided squarely between the arts and the sciences. In fact, much of the rest of the world is split the same way. But my next guest says scientists have a lot to learn from artists. In fact, he says throughout history, artists have made the kind of discoveries that scientists arrived at many years later, particularly about the brain. He is Jonah Lehrer. Great name, no relation that we could figure out during that 60-second break. He's from L.A. And here's he's the author of a new book called Proust Was a Neuroscientist. He also says Paul Cézanne made discoveries about the visual cortex, and Virginia Woolf helped us understand consciousness, and he joins me in our studio now. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you used to work in a neuroscience lab yourself, I understand, where you say you were inspired by Proust. How did that happen?
Well, I was working in a neuroscience lab, and we were trying to understand how our memory works. So what chemicals unfold in the brain, the chemical process that happens in the brain whenever you remember anything. And I was just a technician in the lab, and so doing the manual labor of science.
And you write that Proust had already discovered what neuroscientists were trying to find out decades later. What was that?
Well, so while I was waiting for my experiments to finish, there's lots of downtime in the lab, and I would bring in Proust to read, and I got sucked into the soap opera. I was absorbed in the novels, and slowly realized that the novels were actually anticipating my experiments.
Huh? Give me an example.
So for example, the classic Madeleine episode, where Proust dips the Madeleine in the tea, and then the whole novel really unfolds from there. He recovers these lost childhood memories. Proust is very insistent that it's by taste and smell alone that the memories came back, that he looked at many Madeleines before and the memory never come back to him before. So that there's something uniquely nostalgic about our sense of taste and smell. And Proust was right. You can look at the anatomy of the brain and the olfactory cortex, which is the part of the brain that processes smell and taste. That part of the brain is uniquely connected to the hippocampus, which is a center of long-term memory. All our other senses first go through the thalamus. So Proust really intuited a very modern idea about neuroanatomy just by paying such close attention to his experience, to this act of eating a cookie, of dunking this buttery cookie in tea.
So when people read Remembrance of Things Past by Proust and think they're escaping science class, they're really not.
Yes, well, Proust did really intuit very important ideas about the way our memory works. Very, very modern ideas, very strange scientific ideas.
So listeners, our phones are open on this. Are you an artist or do you call yourself a scientist? How much do you see a gulf between the two? If you are an artist, do you use science to inform your work? If you're a scientist, does art help you get a better understanding of the world? Have you read yet Jonah Lehrer's book, Proust Was a Neuroscientist, which is getting a lot of attention? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post a comment on our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Another example, you single out Gertrude Stein, Paul Cézanne, Virginia Woolf. How did Virginia Woolf scoop the scientists that followed her?
Well, Virginia Woolf, you read some of her writing and she sounds like a cognitive psychologist. She really paid such close attention, I think, in part of virtue of having a mental illness, really forced her to pay very acute attention to her mind, very close attention, and really listen to what she calls the tremors of any of the signs of the illness coming on. And I think that taught her a lot about the way consciousness works, about the way consciousness unfolds. She's got a line about how, you know, the task of the modern novelist is to trace the patterns of sensation, no matter how incoherent the appearance may be, to follow them and to embody that in your writing, in your prose. And so I think she intuited a lot about the way consciousness works, about the way the self interacts.
Do you think she was actively trying to do science or doing scientific observation on herself, or as an artist, was she just writing about her subjective experience but gave us this?
Well, she's got a line in her journals before she began Miss Dalloway that this time she wants to get the psychology very accurately. But I think one thing that did impress me about all these artists is that they took their art very seriously. They believed they were describing important truths about human experience, about human nature. And that they weren't simply making entertaining pieces of work or pretty things or beautiful things, but they were describing important truths, relevant truths. And Wolf was like Gertrude Stein in that sense. She was like Paul Cézanne. She was like Walt Whitman. These were people who took their art very seriously and thought they were expressing true things.
Yeah, and there was a lot of science, a lot of discovery going on at that time. So maybe Gertrude Stein, Virginia Woolf, were also soaking in this atmosphere.
Absolutely. I mean, Gertrude Stein worked in William James's psychology lab at Harvard. She worked in a neuroanatomy lab. So often they, you know, the intersection was literal. But I think they also had a much broader view of truth. I think now we think of truth as being, if it's not stated in scientific terms, if it's not described in acronyms or proteins, then it really can't be true. Then it's just pretty. But these artists, I think, really thought you could express truths about the mind in a novel, in a work of fiction.
So does your work on the intersection between arts and sciences give you thoughts about the nature of truth that might be different than other people's thoughts?
Absolutely. I do think we've kind of lapsed into a very strict version of truth that's perhaps too strict, in the sense that if something can't be reduced into the variables of an experiment, of a scientific experiment, then somehow it's not true. And I think that causes us to overlook a lot of the wisdom which is in these novels. I think the reason we still read Shakespeare, the reason Hamlet's still such an immortal character, the reason we still look at Jackson Pollock's and Cézanne paintings is because these works of art resonate with us. And I think by reverse engineering the art, by figuring out why the art means so much to us, we can learn a lot about the way the mind works.
Jonah Lehrer, author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist, my guest on WNYC, and Jerry in Westport. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What you got?
Well, I'm in the corporate innovation and creativity business, and as I talk to my workshops about corporate and business creativity innovation, it's come to my attention that science, corporations, art, and the military all have something in common in terms of creativity, which is a discipline, a process, and the whole need to define the problem and create lots and lots of solutions and choose from the best solutions to find the answer to their problem. So I would posit that it's not just art, it's not just science, it's corporate creativity, and it's also military innovation. And again, they all require discipline, and they all require a process. Einstein said, give me an hour to solve a problem, and I'll spend the first 55 minutes defining the problem. So I think we all have a lot in common.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's a very broad view. In fact, remember that the 9/11 Commission report, of all things, said right up top that largely what happened was a failure of imagination.
Hmm.
He goes further than you go in terms of bringing the military and all that.
No, but bathing creativity is a very, you know, it's a very tough process to understand and to break down. In terms of the art and science interaction, obviously Proust isn't going to invent Prozac. You know, Virginia Woolf isn't going to help you with your experiments every day, but I think they can help you ask better questions. They can help scientists ask better questions. And as the caller mentioned, you know, the tough part is finding the right questions to ask.
Jordan in Tarrytown. You're on WNYC. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, Brian. Good to talk with you again. I'm a professor of musicology. I'm a composer and longtime performer. And it's been clear to us, I think, in the musical community for a long time that the evolution of the brain and the musical discipline really go hand in hand. I'm actually using This Is Your Brain on Music by Daniel Levitin as a textbook this semester.
Hmm.
And he actually points out quite clearly the similarities in the processes that artists and scientists go through. Also, you all have been featuring so much recently Oliver Sacks's new book. I think all of
right,
this
is about the
more and
of,
more.
Right, Sacks wrote about the effects of music on the brain. So all good stuff. And Jonah, you're right that the main difference between art and science when it comes to the brain is this, quote, neuroscience is useful for describing the brain, and the arts are useful for describing our actual experience.
Yes, and I think what these artists demonstrate is you can learn a lot. You can learn important truths about the brain by studying experience, by paying attention to our experience. So you don't have to just break things down in a lab. That you can pay close attention to experience, the feeling of this here now, and learn from that.
You're also right that art is necessary as a counterbalance to the excesses of scientific reductionism. What's the problem with the reductive nature of science as you see it?
Well, it's been phenomenally successful. The last 50 years, we've really broken the brain into a glossary of acronyms and enzymes and genes and proteins, and that's wonderful and so necessary and important. But I do think that as science begins to tackle some of these really big questions, what is consciousness, what is the self, these emergent phenomena, that it's absolutely necessary that science learn to incorporate other forms of truth. You know, it's not enough to explain consciousness in terms of electricity in the frontal cortex. You know, that just explains it away, but it doesn't really grapple with the, you know, the real mystery there.
And at one point in history, the study of, or the art of philosophy and the art of science were seen as the same thing.
Yes, I think science really has, you know, to its credit, I think amassed a really important body of truth about what the brain is. But we're not just a sack of neurons. We experience something else.
Rodney in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rodney.
Hi. Oh, sorry, I didn't expect to go online. But anyway, I just wanted to find out if the author could comment on the connection between Proust's withdrawal from society and sensory defensiveness and his proclivity to writing,
Well, that's all right. Let me get a reaction. Did you go that far into his own psychology?
Yeah, I talk a lot about Proust's idiosyncratic method. He was a peculiar fellow, he was sick, and he really withdrew into his bedroom and you know, spent years poring over his memory, paying such close attention to his memory that I think that's where his insights came from really lying in bed and paying such close attention to the way his memory worked. So in that sense, his withdrawal into himself led to tremendous amounts of wisdom.
I read that you studied both English and neuroscience in college. Were you a double major?
I was.
English and science.
It was more a product of indecision than anything else. I love novels and I love neuroscience, so I was just too indecisive to choose.
So did your peers think you were some kind of freak?
Yeah, it was a little tough fitting in sometimes, but I was one of those annoying fellows who would go to MoMA and would talk about the visual cortex while looking at a Cezanne painting.
Jeffrey in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hello. I'm a painter, and I've been interested in the work of a gentleman named Paul Ekman in California, a psychologist who's done work into what they call micro-expressions, these fast, fleeting indications of what's going through a person's mind. And I've often thought that what's greatest about Rembrandt's painting is the quantity of human expression that's in them, how they seem alive. And I'm wondering if the author has come across work, discusses the work of Paul Ekman or anything else about the portrait painting.
I mean, and there's certainly, you know, some profound genius in Rembrandt, which you can't quite reduce into microfacial expressions. There's something in that gaze. But yeah, I am familiar with the work of Paul Ekman. I talk briefly about his work in my chapter on Walt Whitman and the relationship of the body and emotion, and how what we think of this emotion is beginning with the brain, actually begins in the body. And I think Ekman's work speaks to that a little bit.
We just have 30 seconds left. Do you think that academic institutions could do a better job of bridging the gulf between the humanities and the sciences? I mean, we really shouldn't live in a world where, you know, your friends think you're a freak for being interested in both English and neuroscience.
I think the boundary's beginning to collapse, and I think it's being led by neuroscientists and by artists. I think there is a new culture emerging of people who do try to bring art and science together, but it takes a lot of work because the vocabularies of these two cultures are very different. And it's important to see that art and science are ultimately different descriptions of the same thing, and it's important to learn how to reconcile them.
Jonah Lehrer, do you have a relative, Francis Lehrer, in L.A.?
I don't think so.
No, I guess we're not related. Proust was a neuroscientist, published by Houghton Mifflin. He has a reading tonight at the Barnes & Noble on the Upper West Side, Broadway and 82nd Street. Watch out for the dirty streets, but have fun up there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.